Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and the greatest of the world of the automobile. Lots of motorsports to talk about. We've got IndyCars up in Portland. We've got NASCAR talking about what happened last weekend as well as this weekend where they are in Watkins Glen, New York. Got a couple articles. One regarding Cybertrucks and why the U.S. Air Force might want to blow them up. Stories about what's going on with Kia and their theft, Volvo. We'll talk about what's going on with our gas prices. And, of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. Well, from the pages of The Drive, the headline reads, Hyundais and Kias are harder to steal now, but the theft crisis isn't over. Well, Hyundai and Kia thefts have been in the news for more than several years now because of some of the models that are easy to steal. The problem has led to social media trends, class action lawsuits, insurance blacklisting, and dramatic countermeasures by the owners. New analysis from the IIHS indicates the Immobilizer software updates are working, but not every car is eligible and not every owner is doing the updates. An epidemic of Hyundai and Kia thefts went crazy in 21 and 22, and the Kia boys were posting about stealing these cars on TikTok, and people figured out you could rip one off with little more than nothing but a USB cable. Now, the automakers tried to blame the cops, but in fact, the cars were being sold without electronic immobilizers, which left them susceptible to easily being stolen. Now, the Korean car company issued some updates, and the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety and the Highway Loss Data Institute have been tracking their effectiveness. And if you happen to be driving a newer Kia or Hyundai, it's kind of good news, bad news. Well, the HLDI has been tracking the campaign's impact since it began in February of 2023, and the latest analysis showed the frequency of theft claims of all kinds were 46% lower for eligible Hyundais and Kia vehicles that received the upgrades versus the ones that did not. The whole vehicle theft were 52% less frequent for vehicles with the upgrades. Now, another signal that the software is working is an increase in frequency of vandalism claims, which reflect the damage that occurred during the thwarted theft attempts. So in 2022 and to 2024 models with Hyundais and Kias with the anti-theft software upgrades are being stolen at 50% less, but they're still being targeted and getting vandalized by people who are attempting to steal them. So having your car broken into, I guess, is not as bad as getting the whole thing taken care of, but it still sucks. And what's worse is older Hyundais and Kias are still getting stolen a lot. And I don't mean old. Just like 2011 to 2022 models that the company hasn't figured out how to update. And according to the HLDI, again, despite the improvements, however, according to the December 24th recent report, in the eligible months and recent claims, the theft frequencies for eligible models of the 2011 through 22 still remain high at nearly 10 and 11 claims per 1,000 vehicles insured for Hyundai and Kia. And only 41% of eligible Hyundai vehicles and 40% of eligible Kia vehicles have received the upgrades as far as December. So it's not surprising that these cars continued to be targeted. So if you're driving a Kia or a Hyundai, you'll definitely want to get the available software updates as soon as you can. And you might recommend a visual deterrent like a steering wheel club or a boot if you're parked someplace where car theft is common. And yes, they can be cut through, but if thieves are looking for the path of least resistance, the inconvenience of stealing one of these cars with one of these tools might be just enough to save your car. Headline reads, Volvo is in trouble. And its solutions are 2 years away. When Volvo reflects on the 2025 downline, history will either define it as a rebuilding year or things definitely took a turn for the worse. After losing over $1 billion globally through the second quarter of 2025, the Swedish automaker reported a 14% drop in sales for this past July. That comes on the heels of a 12% year-over-year drop for June and May each, and an overall 10% slide for the first 7 months of the year. Now, you don't have to be an investor to recognize these numbers are moving in the wrong direction. Volvo said it's taken steps to mitigate the blow, but they're not roundly encouraging. On one hand, the company cut 3,000 jobs globally. On the other hand, it finally moved to build its XC60 SUV, the best-selling model in the United States, at a Ridgeville, South Carolina facility to avoid tariffs. The only problem is the XC60 won't again be coming off the production line until sometime in the latter part of 2027. Providing everything goes to plan, it'll be joined by the XC90 later that year, and it will be a presidential election year that year, so subsequently a new administration will be in place by the time this all takes place. Meanwhile, Volvo's electric flagship, the EX90, hasn't launched in the best shape, to put it mildly. Consumer Reports published alarming lists of issues encountered with this SUV, which starts at $81,000. From third row seats that have trouble folding due to overheating motors, to blind spot warning alarms that go off when the car is stationary, to random audio systems going silent. The experience with the EX90 didn't exactly prop up Volvo's reputation for quality. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, the plucky EX30, which has suffered glitches of its own, finally hit the dealer's showroom earlier this year for about $10,000 more than it was initially advertised to. Now, the government's tariff frenzy obviously isn't Volvo's fault, but yes, it's another frustration at a time for the company. It might just have to adjust its mix of hybrids versus electric models, as global sales of the latter were specifically down 23% through January through July. Plug-in hybrids were off less than 1%, while the ICE cars, the internal combustion engine cars, and mild hybrids were down 7% as compared to the first 7 months of 2024. Whatever Volvo introduces in the future to stem this tide, it won't look like the brand has shown us before. The ES90's raised ride height, despite being a sedan, is no accident. Volvo is the first SUV, first brand now, in words of recently departed CEO, it's more likely to tweak proven models like the XC60 with unique trim packages than to introduce a wholly new model. If that's what Volvo is for now, fair enough, but it still needs to execute on those products properly, which includes their software functioning correctly. So tough times with Volvo, and hopefully this new factory in South Carolina will help prove to be a winner. We'll talk a little NASCAR news. Last week, NASCAR was in Iowa, and the headline reads, Briscoe apologetic for crash and content to rally with a second at Iowa. Well, Chase Briscoe thought he was in prime position to win his second Cup Series race with Joe Gibbs Racing last weekend for the Iowa Corn 350, but much like his teammate Denny Hamlin after his Pocono triumph in June, Briscoe was left disappointed when William Byron hit a surprising fuel number to deny him that chance. Briscoe came home second at Iowa Speedway after a series of final cautions that allowed Byron to stretch his fuel mileage for 144 laps or 126 miles to the finish. The 30-year-old was able to close on Byron in traffic during the middle portion of the stage but couldn't find his way to overcome the dirty air and pass him before losing ground for the final run to the checkered flag. "Yeah, I really thought I was in the catbird seat," Briscoe said. "I got there and I just kind of stalled out. It's kind of what I experienced when I was leading earlier and I caught the back of the field. It was the same thing. As soon as I got there, we just kind of died." Unfortunate. But when you're kind of limited to where you can go with a repave and everything. So overall, it was a great finish for our Bass Pro Shops Toyota. Ending up in second, well, that was a good recovery. Now, Briscoe, a Hoosier, led the field to the green after taking his sixth pole of 2025 on Saturday. He lost the lead on the initial start to Byron, and Briscoe paced the bulk of Stage 2 after his number 19 got him off pit road during the final pit break. The untimely caution ensued during a green flag pit stop cycle trapped Briscoe in the middle of the field, but put him on a strategy that ultimately had him in a position to win. He did, from there, fending off Brad Keselowski and Ryan Blaney in the closing laps to maintain the spot, but there were just too many cautions that didn't force Byron to pit road. Unfortunately for Briscoe, those two cautions happened to be tied to him, involving in two separate incidents with Toyota teammates Eric Jones, Christopher Bell, and Tyler Reddick shortly after restarts in the final stage. The cause of the first accident, well, that's up for debate. But Briscoe took blame for washing up the track and spinning into Reddick and Bell. Want to apologize to the number 45 and the number 20. He said, that was a really bonehead move on my part. Got in there, got loose, and ruined their day. That's 100% on me. Well, this weekend, NASCAR is at Watkins Glen, New York, what a famous and very storied racetrack. And the headline reads, Zilich suffers broken collarbone in Watkins Glen fall. Well, Saturday's Xfinity Mission 200 at Watkins Glen winner Connor Zilich fell from his car during the Victory Lane celebration and was transported to the local hospital for evaluation. He was treated and released on Saturday night. Zilich later posted on X, I want to thank everybody for reaching out today. I'm out of the hospital and getting better already. Thankfully, the CT scans for my head are clear. I have a broken collarbone and thankful for the medics and their quick attention. Grateful that it wasn't worse. Now, the Watkins Glen victor was his sixth of the year for Connor Zilich, which has already been sidelined once in 2025 at Texas Motor Speedway after receiving a lower back injury at Talladega Super Speedway. There's no word yet about missing further races for the 19-year-old. The Xfinity Series is scheduled to be a week off before returning to Daytona Speedway on August 22nd. There are three races remaining in the Xfinity Series regular season. Yeah, I saw a video of this morning, and a lot of times the racers will get out of their cars, take their helmets off, and stand up on the roof and, you know, do the fist pump and then climb back down to talk to the TV reporters. Well, he started to climb back down, lost his balance, and his foot got caught in the window netting, and he tumbled to the ground. So considering what I saw, I thought this thing was going to be a lot worse, and hopefully Connor will be healthy very soon. Well, continuing the thread for Watkins Glen, well, the headline reads, Blaney bests SVG for Watkins Glen Series pole. Well, winning the pole for a NASCAR Cup Series road course typically means outrunning Shane Van Gisbergen. That's exactly what Ryan Blaney did on Saturday. Blaney knocked Shane Van Gisberg from the top spot with a late session lap of 1:22.56 to earn the first starting position for today's running of the Gold Bowling at the Glen at the 2.45-mile road course. Van Gisbergen, sixth in practice, finished second in qualifying at 1:22.51. He'll be in search of his fourth win of the season. Competing in the top five were Chase Briscoe, Ross Chastain, and Kyle Busch. Penske's Blaney scored his second pole of the season and the 150th for the team. Yeah, Bubba Wallace came up to me and said, well, that was a bad idea because Shane Van Gisbergen is going to wax you tomorrow, Blaney said. People ask me, how does Shane do so good? He said, I really don't race very much with him on these road courses. He's usually ahead of me, so it'll be fun to watch him at the start of the race. Well, today's running of the race just started shortly, and that is on the USA Network. Today's race is the third to last of the regular season, Richmond and Daytona to follow. Winless drivers near the cut line will be in search of a victory to push into the playoffs. Those bouncing around the bubble are Alex Bowman, who qualified 7th, Chris Buescher, who qualified 12th, Ryan Priest in 17th, Kyle Busch in 5th, and Busch, who is a two-time series champion, seems to be the best to have a breakthrough win on Sunday. With some more NASCAR news, the headline reads, Stenhouse riding a single-car team roller coaster in the NASCAR Cup Series. Well, last Sunday's Iowa Corn 350 at Iowa Speedway, Ricky Stenhouse guided his number 47 Hayek Motorsport Chevrolet to the 33rd finish. In the past, Iowa has been a solid and consistent circuit for the 37-year-old. Stenhouse placed no worse than 5th in his last 5 starts there, and hoping for a positive outcome on Sunday's race. Stenhouse and the single-car Hayek Motorsports effort has instead struggled all afternoon and ended up 3 laps down. Yeah, we're a one-car team and it can be tough, Stenhouse said, who is currently in 26th in points. It was tough at Iowa. We actually stayed there overnight. We finished 5th there last year, so when you come back, you've got expectations to run like you did last year. And when it doesn't happen, it's pretty frustrating. I've talked to my crew chief, Mike Kelly, and the guys are waiting to get the car back to the shop to see what they can do as far as a deep dive and see why we struggled so much. They'll be at the shop this week working hard to figure things out. Well, after an excellent sixth-place finish at Atlanta back in June 28th, Stenhouse and Hayek Motorsports have seemingly lost their form, placing outside of the top 20 in their last five starts. Stenhouse insists the team and everyone has kept their chins up. It's a David and Goliath battle for us out there. One thing we can do is we can go to bed at night knowing that we're executing. We're not making mistakes at the racetrack. We're not making mistakes in the pits. We've just got to get our cars faster, and that's a trial and effort right now. Actually, some better races have happened at the road courses. At Sonoma, we were in the top 10 with 10 laps to go and got crashed. At Chicago, we were in the top 10 with 10 laps to go and we got crashed. So I'm looking forward to Watkins Glen this weekend. Normally, I'd be more excited about going to places like Iowa versus Watkins Glen, but right now, I'm looking forward to road courses a little bit. It kind of comes and goes with the racetracks. When you're rolling right now, circle tracks, well, we're struggling, unfortunately. But if you look at the last 2 years, I think the execution is what had held us back. We'd be either made bad race calls, pit mistakes, or mistakes by the race car driver on the track. Those things are what have killed our consistency over the last 2 years. But this year, I feel like we're executing at a high level since the beginning of the season. Granted, at the beginning of the season, we got better finishes, but as of late, we're still kind of holding us back is the speed of the car. And we're struggling with that. So I'd give our execution and game planning an A, and that's what we're doing week in and week out. I can't keep that consistency and bring the car level up. When we do, the finishes will start piling up on the good end. Wendy cars are up in Portland this weekend, and the headline reads, McLaren scores 1-2 in Portland qualifying. Well, Christian Lundgaard was the quickest driver on Friday and carried that speed over to qualifying for his third career pole position since joining Arrow McLaren. The Dane led the McLaren 1-2 as the number 7 Chevrolet and Pato Award alongside him in the number 5. But it'll be Award who will start on the pole as Lundgaard will be demoted to 7th for an unapproved engine change. No, honestly, when I crossed the line, I didn't expect it, Lundgaard said of his surprised pole. I just felt like I had a big push in turn number 5 and another big push in 6, and I knew I was slower than the fast 12 lap that I had turned, so I really didn't expect this. But as we were discussing this, kind of the best case scenario for this. Obviously, we get a 6th grade penalty, but I'm really proud of the team. Well, Lundgaard took the pole and then adjusted for the Firestone quick 6. It's Award promoted to 1st. Meyer Shanks, Felix Rosenquist will start 2nd. The number 60 Honda defending Portland winner Will Power from Team Penske will be starting in 3rd. AJ Foyt Racing's David Malukas in 4th. And Alex Palou, the leader of the championship series, who has a chance to clinch the IndyCar title this weekend, will be starting in 5th. So we'll see. I'd love to see Pato Award win this race and somehow Alex Palou drop out and we go to Nashville for the final race of the season to see what is going to happen with regards to, we have Milwaukee and then we have Portland. So we'll see, and I'll have those results for you for the IndyCar race next weekend. Well, Simon, some weird and unusual automotive news, and from the pages of The Drive, the headline reads, U.S. Air Force plans to use Tesla Cybertrucks for military missile target practice. Well, our colleagues over at The War Zone dug up some new intel on the United States Air Force that wants to buy a couple Tesla Cybertrucks to shoot missiles at it, and it's the only make and model called out specifically on a recent discovery of 33 target vehicles to get blown up in White Sands range. Obviously, the image and the idea is pretty funny, but it does seem fairly odd. Now, the military acquires cars and trucks to destroy for training purposes all the time. Typically, the targets are specifically by body style, sedans, SUVs, pickups, etc. But what was reported was an explicit requirement for Cybertrucks, which do not need to be in running condition, but need to be able to tow or roll behind another vehicle. In short, the U.S. Air Force thinks the Cybertruck's unique design and EV powertrain will show up on the battlefield soon. So here's some specific language that the U.S. military is using from the request. On February 13th, 2025, market research was conducted to assess the competition for the Tesla Cybertruck evaluation, its designs, materials, impact-resistant, and innovative technologies. The study reveals that the Cybertruck's aggressive, angular, and futuristic design, paired with its unpainted stainless steel exoskeleton, sets it apart from its competitors that typically use painted steel or aluminum bodies. Additionally, the 48V electrical architecture provides superior power and efficiency, and features that rivals are only beginning to develop. Extensive internet searches and industry outreach found no vehicles with features compared to those Cybertrucks. Now, intends to use the specifically Tesla-manufactured vehicles for target vehicle flight training test events. In the operating theater, it's likely the type of vehicle that will be used by the MNME to transition to Tesla Cybertrucks, as they have been found not to receive the normal extent of damage during a major impact. It also adds the testing needs to mirror real-world situations, and the intent of training to prep for units for operating in similar scenarios as close to possible as real-world scenarios. Well, there's quite a bit of redacted stuff in here, but it's interesting. One of the last paragraphs is an eye-catching situation, especially since there was no details or elaboration what the Air Force means by operating theater in its context. The Cybertrucks are sold in mass in the United States and in Mexico, and some have even popped up in other corners of the world, and they're slated for sales in the Middle East, specifically Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar. Is the U.S. government gearing up to engage targets that were somewhere off the parking lots in Venice Beach? Or are they conveniently looking to take on unsold Cybertrucks off Tesla's hands? I get to the point of the vehicle's design. Either love it or hate it. It's an undeniable, unique looking. But in all seriousness, could the U.S. Air Force get the same results by bolting some angular sheet of metal to a golf cart or a trailer? Cybertrucks don't need to be running. I don't see the practical difference between shooting one of these or maybe a dumpster. Seems a little sketchy, especially if the Air Force plans to acquire six-figure Cybertrucks just to blow them up. Now, if they go pull them from the salvage yard, I guess that's fine. But I still like to know what the military thinks it's going to be shooting at in the near future. Yeah, that's a little bit strange and definitely weird automotive news. Well, time to talk gas prices with our friends over at AAA. Right now, the average gas price in the United States is $3.13. Here in the AZ, $3.17. New Mexico, $2.88. Colorado, $3.04. Utah, $3.35. Nevada, $3.75. And California, $4.49 a gallon. All right, let's see what's going on here in Arizona with our gas prices. Well, if you're looking for cheap gas right now, the Shell station on the Grand Canyon Boulevard in Williams at $4.49, the Maverick at $2.59 in Williams, the Love's Travel Stop at $2.59. How about this, folks? Costco in Gilbert, yes, in Gilbert, $2.59 a gallon, you lucky East Valley folk. The Sam's Club is at $2.59 in Gilbert as well, and if you happen to be down in Tucson, Sam's Club at $2.64 and Costco and Prescott at $2.65. All right, well, we already know in the metro that you can get some cheap gas at Sam's Club and Costco out in the East Valley. What else do we have going on? On Cooper Road, you can get the Arco Mini Mart at $2.86. On Northside in Scottsdale, the Walmart is at $2.87 a gallon. And the Costco on Oak in Phoenix is at $2.89 as well. So for the first time in a long time, well, last week we had some, but there are many places under $3 a gallon. And how about that? $2.59 in the East Valley. That is some cheap gas. So that time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I'm like your favorite older sister, Ray. My 2004 Chevy Silverado 150 truck has 180,000 highway senior citizen miles on it, and I do not like the new trucks. I'm a keep it simple kind of person, and I drive from Marquette, Michigan to Tucson, Arizona every year, 2,200 miles each way, and I do this twice a year. This truck is perfect. Plus, I have a 150-pound dog with me, a Great Pyrenees, which is one of the reasons I got the truck. Now, when the time comes, should I have a new engine or a rebuilt engine put in my old white Chevy? I do not want to give up on this truck. Am I being foolish? Sentimental? I love your podcast and I love your weekly column. And by the way, I always wanted to be a race car driver. I am related to Barney Oldfield. I'm also fortunate or unfortunate to own a PT Cruiser 2026 and a 2006 Crossfire. I love those cars. Thank you for reading this, and that's from Karen. Well, Karen, you do remind me of my older sister, and she's nutty as well. Now, whether you want to get a new truck, well, that's completely up to you. A new truck will be more reliable, more convenient to drive on long trips, more comfortable, and most importantly, safer with all the modern safety equipments. Now, I'm sorry to say you won't have that familiarity of the simplicity of controls, the worn-out seats, and the well-established dog odor that you and your Great Pyrenees love. Now, if you want to keep your truck, I certainly would go ahead and replace the engine proactively. Now, not unless you're currently burning a lot of oil or have any reason to believe that you need a new engine soon. Excuse me, I would not replace the engine proactively. I want to make sure I get that clear, unless you have an issue. Now, I do get to the point of needing a new engine or a transmission before other key parts rust or fail, and you decide to keep this truck, I'd suggest getting a factory remanufactured engine. While you can have a local mechanic rebuild your engine, well, that depends on the person who's doing this. The local mechanic will have to have that skill and the equipment. There's a lot of variables on that outcome. But the factories that remanufacture these used engines, on the other hand, make them almost perfect every time. Rebuild or replace the things that are worn out to original specs. We use a company called Jasper, and they ship that factory engine to us in about 36 hours. They've got a warranty, and honestly, we've never had a problem with these vehicles. You can find an installer on their website, but you're also going to be running into five figures for a V8, and it might not make sense to put that amount of expense in a 20-year-old truck. So I'd encourage you to look at a new truck, especially since you drive across the country. It's got adaptive cruise control, automatic braking, it's got blind spot warning, lane assist to keep you from drifting, and it also has a brand new truck with a warranty. But if you do decide to keep your old truck, I'd get a harness for that Great Pyrenees. That way he can pull you to the repair shop when you break down. Happy travels, Karen. Yeah, I think he spelled that out pretty well. I think for that kind of money, you might definitely be thinking a new truck. But it's hard when you love your old truck like I love my old Toyota. Well, that's all the time we have for the Car Show, folks. My name is Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday. And you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.